Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is I want to welcome you all to the Real Talk with Chris Richardson show. And as you know, this is a special segment, a special one-hour segment to address how do we restore a community slash nation in mourning. So again, this is a special one-hour segment that we'll be discussing tonight. Over the past week, we have seen a litany of events that have unfolded. And sadly, our country is in a state of mourning. We are in a state of mourning. Many of our communities have all been impacted. I would say all of our communities, if you haven't shed a tear over this last week, I can't question your humanism, if that is a word, such a word. But I would say I've shed tears this week, and it's hard to see the events that I've seen on all levels. So we've got a community in mourning. And we've all been impacted. We've seen it on television. We've seen it on our social media sites by these innocent deaths, starting with Alton Sterling. Then we saw Philando Castile. And then on Thursday, on July 8th, millions of households were impacted when we actually saw an innocent coming together, a protest that turned violent with the deaths of five police officers, innocent police officers. So too much bloodshed has been shed, and we've got to talk about what we can do. And I always say this, it begins with you and ends with you. So if you don't change, neither will your circumstances. We've got to really look at what does that really mean at the end of the day. So my show is all about empowerment, helping you to live better, love deeper, and laugh more at the end of the day. But this is a serious issue right now that we really have to talk about. So I am joined tonight by several of my guests who are joining me tonight, and they could all hold down the show themselves, but they found it fit to take a little bit of the time out of their busy schedules. Most of them are actually right now in doing what they do. I'm joined tonight by Dr. Johnny Parker from First Baptist Church in Glen Arden, Maryland. He is the men's leader for men, and he's also in charge of the couples ministry. He oversees that at First Baptist. And many of you all who know, if you've never heard of First Baptist Church in Glen Arden, just, you know, First Baptist is probably one of the larger churches in the region of the D.C. region. Located in Maryland, that's done a number of great things in the community, has a significant impact, and provides many resources to the community with 119 different ministries within the church. I'm also joined tonight by Reverend Queen, who is the youth pastor of the First Baptist Church in Glen Arden, Maryland. Reverend Queen is joining us tonight as well, and a dynamic brother who has a heart and passion for the youth. He has a gift for what he does. And then this brother needs no introduction, my homie, a fellow commentator, figure, journalist who is an author himself, Brother Harold Fisher from the Daily Drum of WHUR and XM Satellite Radio, I'm joined by. And then we'll, last but not least, we'll also be joined tonight by Maryland Delegate Jay Walker. That's right, Maryland Delegate Jay Walker. So tonight we're going to talk about how do we restore a community in mourning. I want to play a song, so I'm going to play this song, and I want you to listen to the words of the song, and then we'll be right back.
My heart is overwhelmed. Jesus, lead me to the rock. Lead me to the rock. Higher than I, oh Lord, higher than I. Sometimes the weight of the whole world tries to slay me, but a strong power from the enemy, God has been for me. So I need to find a place, that special secret place, where I feel the Lord embrace. Place I call my sanctuary, there you. Hallelujah, my solid. You are my firm foundation, my darling, help me sing. You are my firm foundation, my salvation. Tell the Lord he's a solid rock. Tell the Lord from your heart today. It's just a simple declaration. Come on. Release it into the atmosphere. My solid rock. Tell the Lord from your heart. Tell the Lord from your heart. Oh, yeah. My salvation. Yeah. Come on, release it into the atmosphere. He's a firm foundation. Yes, he is.
Well, welcome back again to the show, top of the hour. We've got a heavy heart. My heart pours out right now, family. We've got to talk about this matter and nation, address this as a community and address this as a nation. Harold, thank you for joining me. Reverend Queen, thank you
Absolutely.
For joining me tonight
for
this segment. This is a special segment. Harold, you've been talking about this because I've been listening to you, catching the very end of your show, but your listeners as well have wanted to talk about this. You've talked about race relations and interracial relations and marriage over the week. You've talked about the Dallas police shootings and everything for the last week. What's been the general consensus on your show for most of the people that you've heard from?
Well, I would say that you say that people are in mourning. I don't think that is completely the case. I really think that people are still angry. Earlier this week, we did a show about healing. No, as a matter of fact, it was Friday. We talked about healing in the wake of the shooting. And when I mentioned it on social media, a lot of folks were saying, healing? Are you kidding? It's too early to talk about healing. There are people that are still very, very angry about the shooting in Louisiana, the shooting in Minnesota, as well as the shooting in Dallas. And so it seems to me that, you know, beyond the anger, a lot of people are trying to figure out what action needs to be taken, legal action beyond protesting. There, of course, have been so many protests, but there are still people asking, what do we do beyond that protest? And it seems to me that that is the biggest question being asked right now.
Yeah, without a doubt. Now, Reverend Queen, you are the youth pastor, and I know last Friday that the youth of Merge. Tell us a little bit about that, because you were there. In fact, I know the chief of police for Prince George's County stopped through for the event to visit. You had an opportunity to meet him. Talk to me about the young people. What's the general consensus that they are sharing with you?
Yeah, you know, thanks again for using your platform to talk about relevant and real issues. Yeah, for me, I would have to agree. The young people definitely expressed a level of anger, a level of frustration. Some of them share that they are afraid, it's fear. The reason why we had the town hall, I mean, it was amazing. We were scheduled to have a movie night. We were in our hero series where we was just talking about heroes that people celebrate in Marvel and DC and how does that relate to heroes that we can find in the Bible. And we actually pulled an audible the night before. I got with my team. We stayed on the phone till 11:30 and We were able to throw together the town hall and really give the young people the opportunity to express and share how they feel and have a safe space, a safe environment for them to really, you know, go in. And I appreciated the chief stopping by. I mean, he expressed his willingness to help in any way possible. And, you know, once again, we talked about the relationship that the church has with the Prince George's County Police Department and, you know, over 70 people, 70 officers that work with the church, that attend the church and things of that nature. But the young people didn't want to be in a room with police officers. They wanted to be in a room where they could really talk about the fact that right now in this country there is an undeniable presence of racism and oppression, and, you know, it still exists. So, you know, they were asking real questions. I mean, it was a great, great evening. We did have two police officers share that did come through, and they were able to touch on some things that helped the young people see things from a different perspective. But at the same time, they were able to say these are, you know, African-American police officers, so it's a little different for them. But the reality is that our young people right now, when you, you know, I asked them the question, did y'all play cops and robbers when you were younger? And how many of you wanted to be an officer? How many of you wanted to be a cop? And there were a few of them who actually said, I wanted to be a cop, but I don't anymore. And, you know, then the reality was, you know, what am I supposed to do when I believe that all they want to do is kill me? So it was real, man. It was a real conversation, real dialogue. We're looking forward to the follow-up. We're doing some things with the Together pre-party type thing where we're going to have some artists come in and we're going to give a message about what it means to be together as a people. And again, you know, it's hard to talk about healing until we get into a posture and a position where we're no longer angry and resentful.
You know, I did a segment here. I'm going to come to you with this next question. I did a segment on Monday, this past Monday, dealing with this, and this was preempted before this situation happened. The first situation happened last week. I was doing a segment already on anger, the attitude of anger versus the fit of rage. And we talked about that. So, Harold, you said it, you know, it started out, and I would agree with you. However, I wanted to make sure we put it in a state where we can kind of diffuse the tension a little bit that's there rather than to fuse it a little bit more. The truth is the truth, and yes, it is. But undertone to that, I wanted to – let's talk about this. What are the people so angry about? Let's just call it as it is.
You know, that's such a great question. After, you know, it's been relatively quiet before the Alton Sterling situation. We, obviously, the last really severe situation that we saw was the shooting in Chicago of that young man, and you saw it on video, okay? And, but, you know, since then, we just really haven't seen, you know, high-profile instances of this. It's all been about terrorism. When I'm talking about what's in the headlines, it's been about terrorism. Of course, it's been about the presidential election, and that's pretty much been it. When the Alton Sterling situation came up, you had people saying, "Here we go again." And then when the Castile shooting happened, then that, I think that was the one that really took the "here we go again" to outrage because of the information that we now have about it, his girlfriend going live on Facebook about it. And here's the thing that is really, really disturbing about that, and people have said, since, I would think that since the Trayvon Martin situation or even the Michael Brown situation, there have been all of these discussions about what to do when you are confronted by authority, you know, state-sponsored authority, police officers and the like, and we have to put George Zimmerman outside of that. But, you know, we've been talking about it ad nauseum, and you know, this is the way that you defuse a situation. You talk to a police officer, you know, my license is under the seat. My license is in the glove compartment. My hands are on the steering wheel, and you want to do everything that you can do to make sure that you get out of a situation like that alive. And apparently, Philandro Castile did all of that, and he still ended up dead. And so a lot of people not only are feeling anger, but they're also feeling some hopelessness, because now you begin to ask, so what do I do? And that goes back to what the brother who was at First Baptist was just saying, where, you know, these young people, these young black men, these young teenagers, they have eyes, and they are developing their common sense. And if somebody tells you this is what you do to come home alive, and then you see somebody who did what you're supposed to do to come home alive, and they don't, then that's where it is. I think that putting it in the context, though, when you talk about clearer heads or level minds will prevail in this situation, I think that a lot of people want to take this anger and turn it into action, and that may very well mean beyond protest. That may very well mean at the voting booth, registering people to vote, but also actively talking to elected officials or those who want to be elected officials about what they plan to deal, what they plan to do as it relates to police reform, training, and race relations as a whole. So, particularly as it relates to race relations. Hillary Clinton she talked about that today. President Obama has spoken about that. This week he spoke about that at the Dallas funeral yesterday, the first Dallas funeral, the first three. And he's been constantly talking about it. And even the governor of Minnesota obviously made a comment about it after the shooting last week, that he didn't believe that Castile would be dead if he were white. And he said that racism and these prejudices are very, very real issues. And the bottom line is, it's not just about black people talking about it. White people really need to recognize and have those uncomfortable conversations about it.
So, Reverend Queen, how do we initiate that conversation? How do we bridge the gap when we talk about, on a Sunday, if you will? Sunday is the most segregated day in the country because we don't necessarily fellowship together, black and white, of other nationalities. It is the most segregated day that we come together in terms of fellowship and seeking our higher being in Christ or God, you know. So how do we begin to bridge the race conversation when we live, and if you look at Prince George's County, and I didn't do any statistics on this one, Reverend Queen, but if you look at Prince George's County, everywhere you may go today, most of the people don't necessarily look different. They look more the same. D.C. at one point, Harold, as we know, used to be Chocolate City, and now it's no longer really held the title of being Chocolate City, the way it used to
That's
be
right.
back in the days of Mary Berry. So how do we now try to, you know, infuse cultural diversity conversations in our education system, infuse it in our communities, infuse it in our churches when we don't see it? The only time we may see it prevalent is when we go to work or we look on TV or anything like that. So, Reverend Queen, I'll give you the question first. Then I definitely want to let my heavy hitter, Harold, I know he's chomping at the bit to answer this too.
I think there's two things that we have to look at. One thing that makes me proud is when there are white people who can admit with sincerity and being completely genuine that they do have a white privilege in this country. And then the second part that comes with that is basically being able to acknowledge that it is hard to identify and recognize the bias that leads to the root cause of racism that pretty much a majority of white people have, even if they may not act on it. I think when you just said cultural diversity, the fact of the matter is that diversity in this country simply means adding on things that aren't white, and that's a problem in itself. So when you look at Sunday is when, you know, whether it's segregated or not, there is people coming together to worship one God who they know died on the cross for each and every person to be free. And I think that there's a commonality that can begin to at least have some type of conversation regarding the acknowledgement that this sin exists, that there's this racism that exists in this country that is embedded, rooted, seeped in. I love with the lady, Ms. Elliott said. She said, if you're white and you graduated from high school, then you already have been embedded with racism. And, you know, there's no getting around that, the way that history is taught. So I think that we have to do a better job at teaching. We have to do a better job at, you know, incorporating the not only the history, but just the values and what develops true Christian character within our people, period. But the conversation will not begin and it will not have any type of validity or progress until the people sitting at the table are able to acknowledge the obvious, and that there is a problem, and that there is, you know, just some things. We let the young people come up with some solutions, and some of the solutions that they came up with, you know, that's why I love empowering young people. They came up with some great ideas in regards to how we can do some things to start changing the dynamics of race in this country. You know, I don't have the list in front of me, but I know that some of them included different training for police officers, different training for white people, period. They mentioned, you know, having racial courses that are taught by black people so that there is this element of truth to that. So I don't have the answer right now, but I just know that until more people are willing to sit at the table and say, all right, let's focus on the fact that Jesus Christ calls us to be together. The other thing is, let's recognize that Jesus Christ came and he was on the side of the oppressed. He came for the poor. He came to liberate people who were being held captive, who were being bound up. So if that is the God that we serve and that we acknowledge, and let's talk about the fact that we are still continuing to create a paradigm where that exists, even within the church.
Well, thank you. Harold?
Well, outside of Sunday, I think that, first of all, this is a generational thing, is with young people who have more exposure to people of diverse backgrounds now than ever before. But unfortunately, that may only be true in the big cities and in the suburbs. Rural America is still very, very much, you know, the same. I've lived in Alabama. I've lived in North Florida, in Missouri, in Ohio. And the reality is that most Americans do not live in big cities. Most Americans live outside of clusters of population, and people self-segregate, whether it's on Sunday morning or in school systems, unless they don't have a choice. But with that said, I believe that generationally this is an issue, because when you're talking about, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement, there are white people and other people of color that are not black that are part of this movement because they see it. Because, you know, people of our generation, I should say, we've always known that there have been issues with the police in black communities, for example. But that has always been the case. Video cameras have not been the case. Now we can say this has always been going on, and we can be told you so. And now that young people are growing up, then they begin to see the problem, and they don't have to learn it because they live with it, and then they can begin to really dialogue informally about these issues. But I think also, you know, we can have these things being taught in colleges, we can have these things being taught in high school and middle school. But I also think that
it is incumbent upon black people of goodwill to take advantage of teachable moments when it comes to issues of race. And I think that black people can be really, really, really sensitive, obviously, for obvious reasons. They can be really, really sensitive to slight comments. And I can tell you from personal experience, when I was a news reporter, a TV news reporter in Alabama, for example, I was the first black male anchor in Huntsville, Alabama. That city had never had a black male anchor before. This was back in the early 1990s. And so when I was covering news out in the rural communities, and I would talk to white people who, the only black people that they'd ever seen in person were those that you saw on the Cosby Show. And so there are times when I would talk to them and they would talk about colored folks. Now, this is what I mean. I could have gotten angry, but I realized that not all ignorance is malicious. Ignorance is just simply that you do not know. And so you take that opportunity to calmly and maturely use it as a teachable moment. Well, they're not calling black folks colored anymore. And every time I've had that conversation back then, I always got the response of either an apology or, wow, I didn't know. Because, and this is the piece that I'm talking about, there are still places in America where you can be a white person, live your entire life, and never encounter a black person, never see one. Grocery store, car dealership, in school, in church, on the road. And so when you have an opportunity to have one of those teachable moments, you need to count to 10, take a breath, and realize that ignorance may not be malicious. And if it is malicious, then you still have to deal with it. Because, again, that is a teachable moment.
Yeah, I would agree with you. We do have to take advantage of that, and that's why you guys are here on the call, because I think that you are – every one of you represent a different layer of the community. Every one of you have a voice that makes an impact and a ripple in a pond. And I think that right now what's important is that we kind of come together to have a discussion. We may not solve anything immediately, but we have to start somewhere. And I remember reaching out to each one of you when it first happened and said, hey, we got to talk. And I think the response was unanimous. Hey, I'm in, but I don't know if I have any solutions. And I said, it's okay, because at the end of the day, we can no longer watch and witness what's going on. We've got to kind of jump in the water, and we'll grow our wings, or we'll learn how to swim, but we'll support and hold one another up. Now we're joined by Dr. Johnny Parker. And Dr. Parker, I want to thank you and welcome you to the call tonight for the show. My question is going to be this that I would like you to address is, now, being at First Baptist Church of Glen Arden, we've got a large men's ministry. We have a lot of men who most churches would love to have the number of men that we have. So being that you are a leader, that men respect you, that men value your voice, what do you say?
Right.
Because as Harold said, and earlier Reverend Queen had said, you know, we're not sure if really the title of the show could have easily been titled, How Do We Restore a Community in Anger or Rage, as opposed to How Do We Rebuild a Community in Mourning? So how do we diffuse some of that, and how do we talk to that? Because we know that men typically don't talk. We can see it by statistics that a man who suffers or puts himself in silence, he acts out on that, hence what happened on Thursday of last week with the 5 police that were killed by one man.
Right.
So what do you say to the men?
Well, first, let me thank you, Chris, for doing this and bringing all the guys together. And glad I could get on this conversation. And let me also say this stirs me on several fronts. I'm a father of three sons, 24, a 20, and a 17-year-old. So I'm stirred that way, and my sons have been pulled over by the police, and I have had to have those conversations with them on how to conduct yourself and how to manage yourself. So I'm stirred that way. Then I'm stirred because I'm a New Yorker. I live here in the D.C. area, but I grew up in Jamaica, Queens, New York. So my Sean Bell, I don't know if anybody remembers, 10 years ago, he's my cousin. He was my cousin who, on his wedding day, 50 shots came into the car, police, never convicted. So I've been personally affected by what's going on. And so what do I say to men, to family members, to my own sons? Several things. One of the things is we have to, and I think I just heard coming on someone just speaking to this, we have to be willing to have conversations. It's easy for me to demonize you when I'm far from you. So you take a situation like Ferguson. If Big Mike had knew Officer Darren as Officer Darren, and Darren was doing what I do believe in, community policing and walking through the community, and then Ferguson, if Big Mike and Officer Darren knew each other or had some kind of relationship, that thing could have gone a whole different way and been diffused a lot differently. And so when you're not up close with each other and having conversations with each other, it's easy to demonize, it's easy to pull a trigger. And so I like to see just the policing do more community policing where you're in the neighborhoods and you're interacting and not just there because you got this, you got to respond to a call or you got to pull someone over or whatever. So that's one thing. The second thing, we have to help men process their emotions. I say a healthy me makes a strong we. So what I mean by health, you got to first, men, we have to learn how to expand our emotional vocabulary. You kind of alluded to it, Chris. Whatever a man doesn't talk out, he'll act out. Or he'll bury down and implode from the inside out. So we have to help men process, because that's been the challenge from day one, from birth. Men, just from being a boy growing up, you're told if you fall down, scrape your knee, you're ashamed. Nothing wrong with you. You're a faggot. You're a sissy. You're punk. Suck it up. Nothing wrong with you. So you hear that at 5, 10, 15, 20, you get 25 years old. Guess what you've learned to do? You've learned to suck it up. You've learned to not talk it out, but take your emotions and your wounds and your pain to substances or to sex. So you're right. What happened in Dallas, for example, was an example of someone who was a power keg. I mean, what he was feeling was real. How he chose to handle it was so real and did not have to go down that way. We don't want to see men go, process in emotions that way. So we have to practically model and help men and let men know it is very manly to talk about your emotions. You're not a punk. You're not a sissy. You're not feminine. You are a man, and it's manly. Jesus talked about emotions. Many leaders in the Bible talked about their emotions. And so we have to elevate that and help men process their emotions, and we have to have conversations. I love what Snoop Dogg and the guys in L.A. did. I don't know if you guys followed this or not, but they went down to the precinct and met with the mayor, met with the chief of police, just to say, we want to stand in solidarity with you. We want to have a conversation and get to know you and you us and have a conversation while there's peace in the land. I mean, that's the kind of thing what Reverend Queen did and what happened the other Friday night at our church when the chief of police for Prince George's County came over. We have to be intentional about having conversations so that we're not demonizing each other from afar.
Absolutely, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. And listen, since you mentioned the police chief, shout outs to their office. What we know is that and this is another show we're going to do next week. We're going to talk about influence because some people have more influence because of their position. Snoop Dogg had greater access than one of Reverend Queen's students, who's right now a young man or a young woman. He doesn't know anybody, so he doesn't have a relationship per se. I fortunately have a smaller platform, but I have a relationship with a lot of officers within the county, so much to the point where if the chief wasn't out of town, he would have been on tonight's show. And I've got a litany of questions that I wanted to address, and we'll address that later on. That'll be a follow-up perhaps to tonight's show. But I want to talk about this now, and this is something that I'm hearing kicked around a little bit, and so we've been talking about this whole thing on race relations, and it's something that we cannot ignore. I think I would agree with what Harold said earlier. I think the agenda We have a political race that's going on now. We've got to talk about the agenda. But we cannot, as Dr. Parker said, we cannot demonize one another for our different views and opinions. We've got to come to learn how to put aside our differences, for that matter, and work together. So the question is this. On that note, how do we, and I'm going to throw this one to Harold first. Harold, I hear a lot, we've heard a lot about Black Lives Matter. And so I've seen a number of different posts and things of that nature here just recently today, where folks were that were not black, they were making a post or a comment. It was an Asian gentleman, and he said, you know, hey, it's would you stand against it? Why do you say all lives matter? It's not like the folks who are supporting Black Lives Matter or leading Black Lives Matter say that this doesn't matter. And he said, would you stand up and say, if a person died and you went to a funeral, would you say, well, I experienced loss too? Would you say that just because you believe in someone has cancer, would you challenge them and say, well, this guy has a cancer versus that? So what he's saying is this. He says, look, the notion of Black Lives Matter is not demonizing or denouncing that all lives don't matter. However, what is in right now, what is prevalent, is that African Americans are at a higher disproportionate rate because they don't have access to resources. They don't have access, the resources being education, the resources being jobs, the resources. So there is a higher level there of it. So what is your take on what some of your viewers have said about Black Lives Matter and some of those who have come on? Because I'm sure you've talked about that as well. So let's talk about that a little bit. Harold, I'll start with you.
Well, as it relates to Black Lives Matter, for the most part, because our listeners are mostly black, they don't have to be culturally educated on what Black Lives Matter really means. As a matter of fact, Don Cheadle, the actor, tweeted today, maybe we should say Black Lives Matter too, because of the broader audience. Because as you just said, Black Lives Matter doesn't mean that other lives don't matter. What Black Lives Matter really suggests is that, like the Washington Post Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting has achieved this year, is that so far this year, in 2016, there have been more than 500 people killed by police officers. The lion's share of those people were white. However, 100 of them or so were black. Well, you may say, well, you know, that's only, what, 20%? But what is the population of African Americans in the United States compared to white? It is significantly less, and so as a result, that 100 or so raises the percentage significantly. And so that is the lesson that the broader community needs to understand. Rudy Giuliani, for example, was talking about and the people in the black community needing to respect the police. But as a white man, he doesn't have the history that police have always been, white police officers particularly, have always been problematic historically in the black community. And when I say historically, I'm not talking about just the 1970s and 1960s. I'm talking about the early 1900s. You know, police were not there for black people. They were there to keep black people under control and to protect white people. And so, you know, with that said, I think that, you know, my listeners understand what Black Lives Matter mean. And the other thing, and I think the thing that they would take issue with is the thing that a lot of police officers have always said, and this isn't an anti-police thing because I have a lot of respect for police, and I've been very fortunate, you know, knock on wood, and thank God that I've not had any negative interaction with police, but, you know, and I can, you know, talk about that too. But the thing is, I was born black. Police officers are police officers by choice. Okay, and I've had black officers say when they take off the uniform and they're driving and they get pulled over by other police officers, they also are nervous. So, you know, and I think that is, you know, that is a reality.
Wow. Wow. Reverend Queen, now you have, again, you are the youth pastor of the First Baptist Church of Glen Arden. For those listeners who are just tuning in, that was just Harold Fisher from the Daily Drum of WHUR speaking. Reverend Queen, what's the consensus of the youth today? What, you know, as we talked about earlier on this show, that Philando Castile did everything that he was supposed to do from what we saw. So, as you stated earlier about this, how do they understand race? When they see race from the millennial perspective, what's that conversation sound like in dialogue with them?
I think in it was mentioned earlier in regards to the access that young people have now in regards to more people that are diverse, being able to connect across the globe, whether through social media, YouTube videos, or whatever. So there's kind of this this dynamic in regards to a young person has the opportunity to be super informed in regards to the history of blacks in this country, black people, period, all the way back, you know, into our biblical days, or they can be completely ignorant and have no clue as to why there is this racism or this this oppression that we still see and face in this country. It's always amazing to hear a young person, you know, go deep in regards to who Malcolm X was and who Dr. King was, or some of them get a little bit closer and they'll go back to Tupac, or, you know, some of the more recent black activists or people that were, you know, exciting to them. But when you get into the roots of the Civil War era and the slavery that existed prior to, and, you know, just the whole construction of this country, I had to remind the young people at the town hall, I asked them, I said, can you name any system created in this country that was created for black people, for African Americans? And I said, not organizations, not, you know, historical black colleges, not, you know, they were naming BET, and, you know, young people get, you know, they're trying to figure out something. I said, when you talk about systems, you know, the education system, the legislative system, the judicial system, you know, any of those things, they weren't created in this country. Now, of course, there were amendments added, but that's adding sugar to the cake after the cake was cooked and you forgot to put it in. It's just, it's not the same. So, you know, there's a thing with them now where some of them see it, but some of them are so hurt and so confused because they have no idea where it comes from, what the root is, you know. So there's just this, you know, there's this parallel. Now, me, I have the blessing of being able to, you know, speak from a different context, not just from being a youth pastor, but I'm someone who has had to deal, you know, with being in prisons where the whole officer corps, everybody who was, you know, a correction officer there, because it was a new prison built in a mountain of a small town where, you know, they were just trying to, you know, create jobs, and they had no interaction with blacks at all. So I seen just blatant racism that came up out of, you know, just out of a root of complete ignorance. So I'm able to kind of share what it looks like when you use those teaching moments. I was able to kind of, you know, start sharing, start showing them that, no, we're not these animals. No, we're not what you, you know, what you've seen on TV or what's been depicted in the media. Young people look at themselves and say, there's no reason whatsoever I should be treated differently because of my color. And because, you know, so just basically giving them some of the foundation. When we had that conversation, I, one, have to ascertain whether or not they have a knowledge of, you know, what this history comes from, and then, two, try to temper their passion and their anger into something constructive and creative so that they can change the world like they're created to do. That's one of the biggest things that they struggle with, because they're at a point, the young man told me at the town hall, he said, man, I don't want to grow to be old because I know I'm going to die early anyway. And that's heartbreaking. You know, I got parents calling me. How do I talk to my son? I'm a single mother. How do I talk to my son about what's going on in this country when they're watching black people die on social media videos and they become so desensitized by it that they can't even cry? I had a young lady, I don't know if y'all saw the news report, but she said it in the news interview, I can't even cry. I can't shed no tears because I'm used to seeing people that look like me die violently.
Mm. Wow. Mm. Well, that's a lot. Dr. Parker, I want to give you an opportunity as well to follow up on the same question, you know, about now from your perspective as dealing with couples and dealing with also Dr. Parker has a background in psychology. So it is not just a title that it was appointed to him, but one that he earned. So if I'm going to phrase the question a little bit differently for you. If you were to advise America from a psychological perspective, because Dr. Queen just hit something right there for us. I want to address that. And I've been talking about this too, that I think we've got to protect our eye gate and our ear gate from what we're seeing and what we're experiencing, because there's no difference in a sense. In the 80s, we experienced a war on crack. And then we had a war that was a crack cocaine epidemic that we had, and that was a breakdown. And so Reagan came out with the administration and said, you know, hey, we're going to crack down on coke. So now in 2000, here we are with the war on terrorism. And now we're fighting a different war that we see today, a war that the enemy is sitting back and laughing because at the end of the day, he's been around and prevalent doing his job, and the question is, are we doing ours? And so from a psychological perspective, what would you tell the people, not just the men, but what would you tell the people today about how sensitive this issue is and what they can do to try to minimize some of the things that they're taking in? Because isn't it still traumatizing?
It's extremely traumatizing, and it's so many things, I would say, even like what Reverend Queen was saying about the young people seeing this live. I would say to our country, we need to have appropriate ways to mourn and grieve our emotions. It's very, very. You have to mourn to move on. Okay, you have to mourn to move on. It's easy to look at what we've been seeing, feel the anger, blacks, whites, Asian, whatever your race, ethnic group, religion may be. But if we're going to be healthy from a psychological, one, we have to be able to mourn what we're feeling and talk about what we're processing, what we're feeling in a healthy way. Two, we really need a fresh approach in thinking about leadership. We really do. I think we need to not have a command and control approach to leadership. I have more of a transformational servant type of leadership model where we where we're leading from a place from mayors, from governors to that we get back to calling leaders what we call them, public servants. Okay, and not using the platform or the stage to advance my name, to advance my career, to advance my significance. We can, you know, then we really use it for what it's designed to be, that if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to be in the public eye, that I'm there and we have a fresh understanding of what it means to be a leader, to serve people, to lead people better off than how we found them. And so I think that's important. I think, stop looking for the White House, but start at your house, in my house, in terms of the conversation that it starts one house at a time, one conversation at a time that can change and start influencing communities, neighborhoods, cities, states, and hopefully a country. So, you know, I just think that it has to get back to starting with me. What am I doing? We need to each day have a meeting, quotation marks around me, meeting with ourselves. How am I going to show up? Am I going to show up as an angry man? Am I going to use that anger in a constructive way? So I think it starts there, because when we start talking about, again, getting back to what I said earlier, not being up close and intimate in relationships and getting to know people, it's always them and they. And I never know who them and they are. You know, it's me and you. And the more that we can have one conversation at a time and start with me and what am I doing in my marriage? What am I doing with my sons? What am I doing with my neighbor across the street, with my friends at work? And so I think it starts there on a micro level to then spread to hopefully a macro level in terms of impacting and influencing and moving a country.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just joining us on the show tonight is Maryland Delegate Jay Walker. And Jay, good to have you here on the show, my friend. I know you were just speaking, and I know that you've got other things going on as well. But I thank you in advance, like many of the others I've already thanked you publicly. I want to thank you for joining in. Now, my question is to you: is this? How do we, with all these things that have just recently happened? This isn't new. This is not the first time, unfortunately, that we've seen incidents with police brutality. For a long time, if you've been a Maryland resident and lived in Prince George's County, our law enforcement officers had to change some things. So, Jay, talk to us a little bit about, if you know, history of Prince George's County. And I know the chief is not here tonight. He would have been here, but he's out with his family. I will do another interview with him, maybe one-on-one, to bring him in for that segment. But, Jay, give us a little bit of history and an understanding from a background perspective of some of the struggles that we had as a county, how we moved forward with legislation, and what should we do today with all these different events, and what can we learn from Dallas?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. You've got a great panel. It's been great listening to the dialogue. When you talk about the history of Prince George's County, you know, tell a lot of folks, hey, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles, California. You know, when you grew up in L.A., we knew there are certain parts of L.A. County you did not play in, you know, Culver City, Beverly Hills. Well, Prince George's County was that area for the state of Maryland, for the whole DMV area, which you did not play in. You did not drive there with a headlight out. You did not drive there with a seatbelt out because the consequences were going to be dire. You know, they would throw the book at you all the time. What Prince George's County did, probably during the Wayne Curry administration when he became the first African-American county executive, was we really did truly embrace community policing. You know, having police officers that look like you, that talk like you, that can understand where you're coming from, that aren't looking to just make everybody out to be a victim, but to try and understand the stories, you know, to walk the beaten path, to see what's going on, why stuff is occurring. And I think that we have probably one of the better models in America. Obviously, Prince George's County is unique in that, you know, we're the first, I don't know if we're still the only jurisdiction to go from predominantly Caucasian to predominantly minority, where the education level went up as well as the income level went up. So we embraced that early. And I think what we're seeing now, you know, just across America, and I don't want to talk for everybody, but I just speak on history. You know, I'm a child of hip-hop. I've always said that I'm in my mid-40s, and, you know, I grew up on it. Just imagine, you know, I heard the psychologist talking earlier, you know, images are long-lasting. You know, I grew up saying the stuff that happened in slavery, I wish that would happen to me. That would never happen to me. I wouldn't allow that to happen. But at the same time, when the hip-hop culture came in, we gave such conflicting messages. We said that, hey, you know what? Hey, it's okay to be a drug dealer, to be a baller, to do this bad stuff to your community. But at the same time, they were talking truth, and they were talking about, look at what the cops are doing. You know, cops have been kind of bad for a while, and I'm not an anti-police guy for a while, but there were stories that were taking place. You heard that carried down from the 60s into the 80s, into the 90s, to the 2000s, where we are now. To question ourselves, well, what do we do about it? I think, you know, we sat there and allowed, you know, the drug guys to become glorified, where it became almost cool to disrespect cops. And I don't think we should have been doing that, but there's a reason why that happened. And I think right now, when you look at the youth of America, if I'm a young man that's under the age of 25, I'm thoroughly confused in terms of what I should expect from law enforcement. So when the conversation starts, I believe the conversation has to start with, well, what do you expect from law enforcement? Because you've got clear examples where law enforcement has let you down. As an African-American in this country, there's no question about it, and I give credit to the governor of Minnesota when he was honest and said, if this were a white couple, I don't believe the young man would have been shot. It starts right there, and that's the
Jay, you there? Okay, we just lost Jay, but I'll get his comments as soon as he dials back into the call. Next, let's go to Harold Fisher. Harold, earlier today, and you alluded to this in your comments when we started the show, President Obama was on television giving what we see as another sad memorial speech or commentary with regard to the situation that's happened here. And CNN, just after the show tonight at 10 o'clock, will be doing a follow-up. Now, a follow-up to what, you might ask? Well, there were some questions that CNN put together. And so I want to ask those same questions of my audience or of my guests tonight. And so, Harold, I'll start with you. There were five questions that they asked five African-American men. And number one is, as a black man in America, what scares you the most?
Oh, wow. You know, that, gosh, that's a really, really good question. Because as I said, honestly, even though I work for a black organization, the thing that really frightens me the most is black unemployment. Because without the economic empowerment of black unemployment, that leads to all kinds of social ills. And, you know, you could attribute black unemployment to the rise of violent crime in African-American neighborhoods. When parents are unemployed and they are unable to live in the communities where the best schools are or to afford private schools. So really for me, it would be black unemployment. As I said, maybe you're expecting me to say, you know, a traffic stop, and knock on wood. As I said, I've not had bad interactions with police officers. Part of that was because when I was stopped during my 17 years in TV, I would be pulled over and a cop would look at me, and if it was in the community that I was on television, as soon as he would say driver's license and registration, he was like, oh, hey, Harold, how you doing? You know, because they'd already seen me on TV, so I had that protection. But that, to me, black unemployment, that would be my biggest fear.
Okay. Question number two on this. What do you want others to know? As an African-American man, what would you want others to know about you?
That we are the same as you in a great many ways. We may have different cultures. We have different history, perhaps. But we are not inherently violent. We are educated. We are progressive in our thinking. And more than anything else, when you talk about others, I'm assuming you're talking about people that are not black. I want them to listen when there needs to be a conversation and not just espouse your philosophy, particularly as it relates to race or social issues.
I won't give you all the questions, but I will ask one last question, and it's the third question. Are you hopeful about the future?
Prayerful would be more like it. I can't say I'm hopeful about it, because the more things change, the more they stay the same. We still have a race issue here, and we still have, you know, black people that are still struggling. And so I think that, you know, I am more prayerful about the future than hopeful.
Okay. I'll kick this over. I think, Delegate, Jay, are you back?
I'm back.
Okay. Let me kick the question over to you. As we bring this thing in for a closing, Harold took three of the tough questions. These are questions that earlier today there was an interview done with five African-American men on CNN, and it will air tonight, in fact, at 10 o'clock. So we heard President Obama giving a commentary or a memorial statement and remarks earlier, and he kind of went in. So I'm going to ask three questions to you as well, and I'm going to do that for the rest of the panel. So, Jay, my first question to you is, how do you diffuse tension as an African-American man? Jay, by the way, if you haven't seen Jay, what are you, 6'4", 6'5"?
Yeah, I'm 6'4". I'm a large African-American man.
Yeah, you're a large African American, so please see you or something, you know. How do you diffuse the tension?
Look, know your situation, know who you are, where you are. I had to talk with my son. He was so, you know, captivated by what was taking place on TV and just seeing this stuff, and he's 10. And so I told him, you know, we had a talk, and I said, son, one thing I want you to do is don't use the word why. When you're in a situation, if you're ever pulled over and you're in a situation where tension's high, if you say, why did you do this, why did you do that, the answer you get back is not going to help the situation. So I think it's know your situation, get home, be, you know, subservient, which is, you know, oxymoron because we're teaching our young our men to be young, black, strong leaders. But I just need you to get home. If you have to be the nicest, softest guy you can be, I need you to say, yes, sir, no, sir, I'm sorry what I did, and get home to me. So know your situation. And, you know, I think we've heard people say, and I heard Harold say, you know, history's repeating itself. We thought things were getting a lot better, but deep down, we haven't achieved as much as we thought we'd have.
Second question I would ask you, as a black man in America, what scares you the most?
Guns, just straight up guns. I mean, you know, it's like when I'm a legislator and I talk to folks, and you know, on the other side of the aisle, you got the folks who love all the guns, you know, NRA, all those groups. And keep in mind, you know, I've got a gun manufacturer in the district I represent, but I mean, we're a violent society, and I don't care if you're black, white, you know, Asian, Japanese, whoever's got that gun in that situation is in a position of power, and there are way too many guns on the street. Just way too many guns on the street. So I just think the amount of guns that are on the street is frightening.
Last question for you.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
That's Harold, right? That's
saying.
You, Harold?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that, you know, 100%. You know, there's too many guns, and you know, there's this love affair that some Americans have with guns. I do not understand it. And, you know, I understand hunting, I understand self-defense, but again, the love affair of high-powered rifles, and I just don't get it. And I believe in the Second Amendment, but I don't own a gun.
But what's interesting about that debate, you know, what's interesting about it, because, you know, they'll throw that on you, the Second Amendment says arms. Tell my colleagues, you know, I've grown up seeing guys shoot Uzis, you know, in the eighth grade, which is scary how they would get it. But we define stuff. It's like, well, if I were to go out here and brothers were to start figuring out ways to make nuclear arms, nuclear weapons, then you would want to take it from us. And that would be considered an arm. You know, you don't want us to have a bunch of grenade launches. So we do define what's acceptable arms and what's not. And for us to go out here and say, you know, it's a lot easier for folks to have more ammunition than law enforcement, that's a kind of scary thought. And that's why I say just guns. That was my generic answer. Just guns. Have to do something about it.
Are you hopeful about the future?
I am, only because, you know, I go back to when I remember stories when my dad told me, man, I had to walk, you know, 5 miles just to get on the bus, just to get an education. And we provide options for education. I just think we need to value education. I say we, I'm talking about African Americans. You know, I should probably talk more, you know, Americans in general, but I talk in terms of the opportunities out here now are so much greater than they've ever been before. I mean, many people know, I was a black quarterback. Growing up in the 60s, you couldn't dream of being a black quarterback. I became a black quarterback in the 90s. We've got black quarterbacks, you know, by the dozen now, which is a great thing. You know, we do practice integration, but there's certain things that really get in the way of it. I think it provides hesitation for acceptance. And that's something that worries me. But I do believe that if we, you know, get guns off the street, stick and practice what we preach. I mean, the Constitution, if it's preached to you, it's probably the greatest working document ever. But it's the method. It's how do you practice that. And if we practice what we preach in terms of the Constitution, then we've got to find a way to overcome. So that's why I try and stay positive. You can't look at the negative. We've had some setbacks, but, you know, like Dr. King said, and the spiritual always said, we shall overcome. It's just, this is a setback.
Dr. Parker, I'll save you for last, for closing comments and perhaps a closing prayer. Reverend Queen, I want to come to you next, and I got three questions for you as well. So I'll start with you from the voice of the youth, but what do you want others to know?
Chris, before you answer that, I want to beg off, because that CNN special that you did mention is on, and I want to have an opportunity to absorb what's happening. So I want to say goodnight to you and to the other guests, and I really appreciate you having me on. It was really interesting and thought-provoking.
Farrell, thank you again for your comments and your professionalism. We appreciate you, bro.
All right, thank you so much. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Reverend Queen, I'll ask you.
Yes, sir.
Again, what do you want others to know?
From a personal standpoint, I would say that I think that everything that is happening is not outside of God's control. And I do believe that this country is receiving a wake-up call in regards to some of the things that we have gotten away from that have impacted and affected how we engage and behave as a society and as a people. I want people to know that there's a strong need to get back to family, that we have an extreme breakdown into some of the developments. I mean, it shouldn't have to be that we have to train our children how to interact and engage with police officers only when something has happened that has impacted us in a negative way. I believe that we should be doing what the Bible says and training up our children in the way they should go, period, so that they do know how to have character and respect when they're dealing with authority in any way, whether it's police officers, teachers, parents, youth pastors. Let me definitely throw that in. We come across a lot of young people who don't know how to interact and engage socially. So I think that I would want them to know that, and I would also want them to know that our young people are going to be either the generation that is going to tear everything apart because they're so angry and so hurt, or they're going to be the ones who build everything up because they have seen the errors of the generations before them. And I look forward to, you know, playing some small part, planting some seeds that will help our next Dr. King, our next whoever. We don't have that leader that can spark the whole country the way they did. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I said I would give three questions, but in the haste of time, and I want to respect your schedules as well, I'll give you one final question before we throw those back over to Dr. Parker. What do you want?
Sure.
What advice do you give to black youth today?
What advice?
What advice do you give the black youth?
Well, for me, I mean, you know, I don't want to keep minimizing my role in regards to just being a youth pastor. I'm a father, I'm a husband. I speak to, you know, black youth in the same manner that I speak to black families, as well as the way I would speak to white people. And I think that the main advice, the main insight I would give is to let us do exactly what the Bible commands us to do, and that is to love one another. I think that if we can get back into a posture of where we truly love each other the way God loves us, then it will be so much easier for us to have those conversations and those dialogues that can eventually lead to some of the reconciliation and some of the healing that is needed in this country. The advice I give to young people specifically is to take the anger and the frustration and the fear that you have and turn it into energy that can be constructive and changing this world and changing and doing something. I believe that mentoring is a strong component, so I champion and advocate for men to get involved with young people's lives, especially with the amount of broken homes we have in the the black culture. I think that it's imperative that we have people standing in the gap while we have this mass incarceration that is keeping families separated and things of that nature. So my biggest advice is for us to really come together and unite in a way that's going to change this world. That's my hope, that's my prayer, and my encouragement to our young people is that you can do it. You are the ones that God has ordained and destined to do this work.
Excellent. Dr. Parker, we'll throw it over to you for the last two closing questions before we end the show.
Sure.
And I got to ask this question because I've asked it pretty much for the majority, but as a black man in America, what scares you the most?
You know what? It's probably more for my sons. It's not less for me. I'm 54. I'm not an old man, but I've had a lot of great things. If I were to die tonight, I've lived a blessed life. I've had to do I lived a blessed life. It's for my sons. It's for grandsons and daughters that aren't even born yet. That probably, I don't think in terms of fear per se, but I hear what you're saying on a human level. It's my sons being misunderstood as African American men. So that's one hand. On the other hand, my hope ultimately, because I'm a man of faith, is in the Lord. And so I have that. I do have that hope. So that's my. Those are my thoughts to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. And this question is different from any other question I've given to any of the other guests tonight. Where do we go from here? Where do we bridge? How do we bridge the gap? Taking what we've talked about tonight, there's been a lot of great comments that have been shared, a lot of great thoughts from thought leaders that you all actively involved in the community. How do we bridge that on a bigger level to spread that message, to spread that love and that unity? How do we do that?
Yeah. It's a great question. It's a big mountain, man. But I think it's one step of many steps. You know. Well, again, I'm speaking as on a large part of my response, being a minister of the gospel, being a professor at Johns Hopkins. So understanding social science, understanding research, but also understanding faith. I understand this. Government, society can make laws, and we need that. And God is not anti-government. God is pro-government, pro-law, and governments exist to protect and serve its people. So we're not that. We understand that government can make laws, but only the gospel of Jesus Christ can change hearts. So, you know... So how does that happen? I've been saying it throughout my conversation, my words tonight. It happens through conversations. It happens through being willing to have conversations with people who don't look like me, who don't think like me, who are gay, who are black, who are white, who are Asian, who are, you can't legislate this. It's got to be. I'm at a place where I'm challenging men in my age, men in their 50s and 60s who are in their legacy years. Because I really think it starts there. I think it starts with all people, but I offer a unique challenge to men of all races to be men who live beyond you. To me, the boy lives for himself. The man is built for others and is built to serve and leave others better off. So that starts with my wife, that starts with my sons, that starts then with my community. Here in the Laurel Beltsville area, I'm looking at how can I get involved in serving Laurel High School. I think it starts with that. It starts with my neighborhood. So instead of having this, man, where do I start? It's a big elephant. I guess that's overwhelming. But I think if we get more people, particularly my challenge is to more men of all races and mobilizing men to think, man, you want to be a great man? You don't be a great man by serving yourself. The problem with the self-made man, he has a problem. The problem with the self-made man, he worships his maker, worships himself. That's not the way of a man. It's the way of a boy. So I think it starts with that, Chris. I think it starts with
how do I use my unique gifts? Jay does it. You know, I remember when you played football, Jay, you did it on the football field. When you did that, you're now serving in government and in politics. You're doing it there. I'm doing my part in the church. I'm doing my part as I work with NFL teams. I'm doing my part serving in my community, being an executive coach to companies, teaching at Johns Hopkins. So wherever I have a sphere of influence, that's what I use, and that's my challenge to all men, to have that mindset and have a mindset of this: I'm built for leadership beyond me. Lead beyond you. Lead with a mindset of leaving others better off than how you found them, and of all people. So just living a given day with a mindset, as I go out, how do I show up in the world today? I show up and I exist to, as a married man, love my wife well, leave her better off, love my sons well, leave them better off, teach them, love the people I interface with, my students at Hopkins, the people at my church. And I just think it starts there, and not just be a cliche one life at a time, but deliberately and intentionally, because no one drifts towards success, right? No one drifts towards love. You have to be intentional about it. You have to be strategic about it. So I believe it requires that, Chris, a personal mindset, a personal approach. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you all tonight for this segment. We went a little bit over 60 minutes, but I really appreciate what you all have brought to the table, your uniqueness, your gifts, your thoughts, your ideas. And that's what it's really about. It's coming together to talk and just have a discussion. I would encourage men, just like Dr. Parker had done, just did, don't be afraid of the conversation. In fact, be afraid of the thing that you don't talk about, because what you don't talk about, you'll suffer in silence about. And so what we just have to do is just one step at a time. One step at a time is how we do that. Use your unique gift, whatever that is. Next week's segment on Monday, we're going to talk about that. What's influencing you? What's influencing you? Today we live in a culture. Is it fear? Is it faith? Or is it Facebook? Well, that's it for tonight's show, the special segment, a one-hour segment that we said on the Real Talk with Chris Richardson show. I want to thank each of my guests, Jay Walker, Dr. Johnny Parker, Harold Fisher, and Reverend Jonathan Queen. Thank you each for taking out the time. I pray that from this point out that we will mobilize within the resources that we have within our churches, within our communities, that every listener that will listen to the show tonight presently or who may listen to a podcast of the show will find yourself doing more than just focusing on you, as Dr. Parker had said. So thank you all. Good night. God bless. And I'll see you next week.
Good night.
Thanks, guys.
Good night, man. Great show.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Sorry about the mix-up I had with the phone dropping on me, but, you know, down there in South County, Chris.